Golf for me is that feeling that you get when you walk down the first tee of any round of golf. You've got a spring in your step, you've got a little bounce, and you're thinking, there is nowhere else I would rather be right now than on this golf course, and I'm trying to keep everything else away, whether it's family stresses, work stresses, trying to just eliminate all of that for that brief period that you're out there in the countryside, breathing the fresh air, beautifully mown grass. For me, there is nothing better than that.
Hi and welcome to Golf Yourself Healthy. I'm Chris Lynch, founder and host of GYH. You are listening to an audio-only version of this podcast. If you'd like to not only listen but also watch the video version of this podcast, please use the link in the show notes to access the GYH Substack, where you can subscribe for free to access the video version, as well as exclusive weekly content and member discounts with leading golf brands such as Vice Golf. So let's introduce today's guest, Dave Jones. Many of you watching or listening will know Dave for his role as lead Sky Sports football presenter, an anchor role he has held for many years now and is clearly, as you'll hear in this conversation, his dream job. However, amongst his other passions and pastimes is golf, a game he has been enjoying and working hard at in recent years. In this conversation, we chat about Dave's journey to reaching a single-figure handicap and the trials and tribulations which went with it, and in particular, the feeling Dave had when he reached that milestone. We also talk about his participation in the Pro-Am at Wentworth back in September last year and how he looks back on the experience of playing alongside none other than European Ryder Cup captain Luke Donald and the lessons he learned from one of the game's most respected players and leaders. Those of you who regularly listen to this podcast will know that at GYH we believe in golf's ability to help us build resilience and overcome adversity. As such, it was very moving to hear Dave share his experiences of supporting his good friend and fellow Sky Sports presenter Simon Thomas following the sudden passing of his wife Gemma due to blood cancer. Dave has for several consecutive years now hosted a charity golf day in support of Blood Cancer UK, and to date has raised over £400,000 for the charity and taken the event to many leading golf venues such as Sunningdale for the 2024 iteration. Above all, it's Dave's summary of how golf helps him to switch off from the stresses of work and day-to-day life, which will resonate with so many of us and embodies our motto here at Golf Yourself Healthy. That is, to embrace the rough and forever cherish the fairway. Without any further ado, let's tee off and jump into the conversation. Dave Jones, warm welcome to the Golf Yourself Healthy podcast. Many of my listeners will know your friendly face and your dulcet tones, Dave, for footballing reasons. I've brought you on this podcast to speak about golf, but the one and only football question I'm going to ask you is this the year your beloved Sunderland get promoted, Dave?
Fingers crossed, Chris. I hope so. I hope so. As we sit here now, we're in a very strong position. There are unfortunately three other clubs who would say exactly the same thing, and only two will go up automatically and the rest will have to fight to the death through the playoffs, which is a sort of chilling, thrilling, horrendous prospect. And I'm very hopeful that we will be spared that this time and we can go straight up through the automatic promotion. But I don't have a crystal ball to hand, so I'm just going to have to keep my fingers crossed on that one.
Well, I'll keep them crossed for you too, and hope the automatic promotion, like you say. I mean, for the neutral anyway, the playoffs is it's great entertainment to watch. It's proper drama, isn't it? But not for someone that's got skin in the game with a certain team. Anyhow, you have golfed for some time now, from what I can gather. But certainly, from what I can see in more recent years, you've really thrown the kitchen sink at it, so to speak. You're really going hard at game improvement, and from what I can see, you're golfing yourself healthy in the process of doing so. So maybe just a good starting point would be to understand, you know, what, tell us a bit about your golfing journey, how your golfing life started.
Well, Anyone who knows me will know that I don't do anything by halves, Chris. That's the first thing. If I'm gonna be involved in football, then I may as well be director of the club that I grew up supporting as a child. If I'm gonna work in television, I may as well be fronting Super Sunday and Monday Night Football, the two shows that I used to dream about presenting as an aspiring journalist growing up. And it's the same in my personal life. You know, I was a very, very keen sportsman as a kid. I played everything pretty much apart from golf, to be honest. I grew up playing cricket. I spent hours practicing, batting, bowling in a field, in a net with my brother, catching. So football when we could, groups of mates down the park, the old cliches, jumpers for goalposts, running, athletics, rugby, tennis, whatever it was, I wanted to do it. And I think I probably associated golf with being a pursuit for older people probably at that stage. It never felt like it was available to me as a youngster. And it was only when my dad sort of retired, because he played cricket as well, when he stopped playing cricket in his 50s, he started playing golf, and I would go along and caddy for him sometimes and effectively carry his clubs, and then develop that interest in hitting a ball myself, but never really sort of got terribly excited about it until I joined Sky actually back in the late 90s. And there was a group of lads who worked similar shift patterns, and just one of those things that we found to do as a collective when we weren't working was to go and spend some time together, getting to know each other better. What better way to do that than hacking our way, and I mean literally hacking our way around Richmond Park Golf Course, which wasn't of the highest standard back then, but it was always open and it was always available, certainly during the week. And we'd go and have a pint afterwards, and it just felt like a really nice thing to do. And, you know, I suppose the natural thing then, as someone who's incredibly competitive, and not just with the people around me, but with myself, is to try and get better at it. And I suppose I got to the point after my son was born, I stopped playing for a while and then found space in my life to take it up again, particularly during the week when other people were working and I had some time off from Sky. It was a nice thing to fill my time with, and then was just getting incredibly frustrated at this game that I'd so much enjoyed playing, but didn't feel I was getting any better at. So then I decided to go all in and get myself sorted with the clubs, get myself sorted with all the gear, advertise for a really good coach, and actually spend some time practicing, which I'd never really done before. And yeah, I think it's fair to say that my game reaped the benefits of it, to the point where I set myself a target of getting to single figures, and I managed to do that last year. I say I'm a single figures golfer, but I'm not. I mean, you know, that's that world handicap system. I'm 9.8, but how often I actually play to single figures is a moot point. And yeah, I think the better I got, the more I actually enjoyed it. And that love just developed, that you know, that passion for it, that nonstop thinking about it, going to sleep thinking about rounds that I was about to play or rounds that I had played, courses that I was going to visit. It just snowballs once you're in it, and then once you get the bug, it's very hard to find a way out, Chris, as you well know.
Oh yeah, that's definitely relatable. Dave, first and foremost, you have no idea how much it pleases me to hear that your golfing kind of journey started out in Richmond Park, because that is pretty much where I, you know, I'm from the north of Scotland, home of golf or whatever. It wasn't until I moved to London about 10 years ago and then took it up at Richmond Park. I just love that place. It's like my spiritual home in terms of golf, but there's a modesty to the place. Like you say, it's not necessarily going to shoot the lights out in terms of facilities, but it's, did it have both the Dukes and Prince's course at the time when you played there?
There were two courses. When I played it, there was a different entrance to the golf course. I believe it's changed. I've not been back since they moved the entrance. There was a very small driving range. There was somewhere you could get a cup of tea, but I don't think they had a bar there from my memory. We used to go to a pub called Jim Thompson's down the road in Barnes, but that's not there anymore. That's a Tesco supermarket, I think.
Oh, jeez.
But they used to do Asian food and Guinness, which was an amazing combination. So we had these amazing prawn crackers with our Guinness, and it just felt like the most perfect thing in the world after a round of golf.
That's some great golf nostalgia right there. I know it does have a modern clubhouse now. It's probably, yeah, it sounds like it's had a few things added to it since then. And I live in Wales now, right? So the chances, I do go back to London with work every now and again, but I'm determined to go back and play at Richmond Park again for old time's sake at some point. The point I want to add, this point on getting to single figures, Dave, because I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will relate to that, you know, sort of when we've got golf goals, like having that metric, the handicap is often that go-to one where you can really tangibly measure that thing. So I almost wonder, when you got there and you got to that single figures, tick that one off, how did that feel? Because a lot of the time we can chase a goal, and then when we actually get there, we either kind of go, meh, or I'm going to keep going now, or how do you reflect on that?
I felt, Chris, to be honest, I felt a little bit fraudulent, which might sound like a strange thing to say, but I think essentially what happened was I learned to drive the ball, and then I was finding myself off the tee, 270, 280, down the fairway, but in play. And this was suddenly a different game to the one I'd been playing before. And everything then felt a lot more straightforward. So to get to single figures on the World Handicap system, essentially, if you are consistent with your scoring above that mark, but then are able to produce two or three rounds that are significantly below that mark, then you can make massive progress quite quickly. And that's what I did. So I had, at the start of last year, well, it was over last winter that I decided I was going to really attack this. And I was actually practicing inside every week, at least once, sometimes twice. And I'd never done that before through a winter. And so that my ball striking, by the time we went back to the course, was just on a different level to it, where it had been the previous end of the year. And I was finding myself quite commonly in situations where I was reaching the halfway mark level par. And that was so far away from where I had been in my previous golf. And I was kind of looking around going, this doesn't feel right. There's something not quite right about this. Hence that kind of fraudulent bit. And then I stopped the practice because the sun came out and I just wanted to be outside. And this is my big thing about golf, is I just love being outside, Chris. And I love being in the sunshine and walking on a golf course, all that, the exercise of it, all that. I don't really enjoy investing that time going and hitting balls on the range. But as soon as I stopped doing that, my golf deteriorated. And to the point where very quickly I was clinging on to that single figures status. And I mean, you can manipulate it pretty much. You can go down to a golf course, and if you've been hitting good balls that week, you can say, I'm going to put a card in, because you know you're actually playing well. And there is a chance that you can improve your handicap in that single round. By the same token, if you're not in the ball well, if you're completely off your game, then you're not going to declare the fact that you want to put a card in, and you can merrily bob along for a couple of months without having your handicap change. So it is a little bit arbitrary, that number. What I would say is I didn't really feel like I'd achieved too much, apart from it was a bit of a line in the sand. And my headspace at the back end of last year was, wow, I know what I need to do to really become a good golfer now, because I'm still not a good golfer, but I know what I need to do now. And that was invest time in my short game, work on my longer irons, practice putting, which I haven't done in 25 years of playing golf. All those little things, which I felt could really make me a consistent single figure golfer, which is a different thing to being saying that my WHS is 9.8. That's how I see it.
Yeah. There's an article I read, might include it in the show notes, which I think was, you were interviewed in National Club Golfer talking about you and your relationship with Gary Munro, the PGA pro that you've been working with. And I think the headline that was used there was, battling with my golfing demons and my game had descended into farce. So, I mean, when you presented to working with Gary at that time, you know, kind of where was your game at, and what were the kind of things that, what did he identify, which were there fairly major material things that needed to be worked on, or was it almost like a collection of small things that work up to a bigger thing?
Well, I think the first thing that he said to me was, when you're standing over the ball, what are you thinking? Tell me what your swing thoughts are. And unfortunately, after an hour of talking to him about all my swing thoughts, we had to leave it there because we ran out of time in the lesson. So that was kind of the starting point. I think I was probably a natural ball striker as a cricketer. So I would stand up and hit the ball, and there wasn't a lot of finesse to it. And there wasn't a lot of rhyme or reason. Try and get the ball somewhere between the middle of my feet. And when I've got the driver in hand, give it merry hell. Gary taught me, broke down the swing quite fundamentally for me. And that's what I was looking for him to do, so that we thought about every little piece and then reassembling. So starting with the grip, I think probably that would be the natural thing to do. And then working on the takeaway, working on the hip turn, working on my body position at the top of the swing, and then trying to get it down through each sequence. I've then been in a driving range and doing this sort of sequencing stuff and had other pros come up to me and go, what on earth are you doing? You know, you're not going to hit a golf ball if you're standing there doing that. So everyone's got a different method. And actually that pro that did say that to me, tried to correct me from doing that stuff, actually had some very good reasons for doing that as well. But it was quite a painstaking process, I would say, with Gary. The biggest challenge that I had with Gary was purely geography. And so that I think we had 8 sessions together. We could have done with another 8. And really, I think when you find a coach that you're very happy with and knows your swing and knows how you work, you've got to really try and keep them. And you've got to sort of make a few sacrifices, I suppose, to try and keep them as well. And you've got to put the homework in. That was my biggest learning, that there's no point, a bit like anything, you know, whether it's Spanish lessons or you're learning to play an instrument. If you just turn up week to week, having had the lesson and then not done any of the work in between, it's pretty pointless as an exercise. You need to go and instill all the stuff that you've been told. Try and reconfigure your brain and your muscle memory so that you're picking up at a different point every time you go back for a lesson. So that would be my sage advice to anyone who's in a similar journey.
Well, no, that's point, especially on, I talk to friends who are golfers or various other golfers, especially since I've been doing this podcast, who will fall into a trap sometimes of thinking, if I go for the best in the game, as far as the best PGA pro or out there is concerned, and I'll pay top whack, then that's a silver bullet. But it just isn't, as you say. You know, you've got their teaching quality is brilliant, obviously. And that's why they charge what they do. But it's on you. You've got to take accountability then, don't you? So,
I would just pick up there, Chris, and say that because of the geography and various other reasons, I just couldn't get back with Gary last year. So I actually ended up picking up with a coach at Dulwich, Ben, who's the head pro there. And he was an absolute master. And this feeds into your point that you're making about, you know, whether you are paying top dollar for, you know, top PGA pro or someone from your local club. It doesn't matter if they've got the eye for it. And actually, he's a really good teacher. And I was in a right mess last year, sort of halfway through the year. And I just completely lost my way. And it can happen to a golfer, particularly when they've had lessons and they're trying to work things through. And then you're on the course and you forget to practice and da, da, da. I got invited to play in the BMW PGA. And I was pretty terrified about the prospect until I picked up with Ben. And in one, I'm not kidding you, one half an hour session, he completely sorted me out in terms of my driver. And that was the biggest mental hurdle I had to play in the event on the day, was because I was genuinely worried about what I was going to do with the golf ball standing on the tee. And it's one thing, actually, the embarrassment of missing the ball or slicing it or carving it. The other was actually the physical danger that I'm putting people in. If I can't control the golf ball, I don't know what it's going to do. So in half an hour, Ben completely sorted me out. You know, and I'm hugely grateful and thankful for him, because it absolutely elevated my experience on the day.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that. And so with what he helped you with, was that ultimately a mental thing, and or was it a technical swing thought or something?
It was all quite technical, Chris, to be honest, because I got myself in this weird position with my driver. I mean, do you want me to sort of talk about it in a more technical way?
Well, I mean, you can do if you like, absolutely. I'm just curious, because I think, you know, what I did want to ask you as it related to that was, because when you were talking about the driver, it being the driver was the thing causing you the fear. If it were me, I mean, the very thought of playing the Pro-Am at Wentworth fills me with excitement, but it fills me with equal dread, because the thought of standing there in the first tee with the driver, although it's good on it on a given day, I would just be worried that I would just have this block, and it's the mental thing that would just take over. Equally, yeah. So no, feel free. Tell us what it was.
Basically, I'd got it into my head that it was a completely different swing for the driver. So I was sort of legs really wide apart, almost like in this ridiculous sort of sumo position, but leaning back and trying to hit up on this thing, and then trying to sort of create this big draw on it. And he was like, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" So he got me into this position, which felt, again, all in sort of 30, 40 minutes. He got me in this position that felt completely unnatural to me. But it was essentially the same position that you would be hitting, I don't know, a 4-iron or a 5-iron. Much more upright, taking real care over my takeaway of the club and just having a couple of little checkers, closing the club face on the way up, so that that would make sure that I wasn't going to open it on the way down, and therefore I was going to eliminate the big slice, and being really aggressive when I came down on the ball, but not in a jerky way. And within 40 minutes, 30, 40 minutes, it felt quite natural. And then I went off to the range and hit it, and I was like, this is working. And I couldn't get my head around the fact this is working. So when I got to the first tee, Wentworth, I'd already played. And the first tee is significant because I already played 16, 17 and 18 without too much fanfare or without really anybody watching, because that's just the way that the day sort of works. And because it's one of those formats where you pick the best drive. So they picked my drive on the first hole, that's our 16th, because I'd managed to get it away.
So was it like a shotgun start then, basically?
Yeah. Exactly. So there was someone else's drive on the 17th. Might have been Ben Stokes. They used his drive on 17. 18, I actually took a 5-wood at Wentworth. If you know the hole, the big dog leg around the corner. And I hit a 5-wood, best one I've ever hit in my life, probably. And they ended up using my 5 over other people's drives to get in. So I was actually feeling quite confident by the time I got to the first tee. And then there were hundreds and hundreds of people on the first tee. And you're having your name announced. The stands are full all around you. And you just think about how nervous the average golfer is when a group in front asks them to go through, or like there's another group of golfers arrive on the tee before you've teed off. You know, if I think about my brother, for example, he'd be just like desperate to get his drive away before anyone turned up on the tee. And, you know, I did forget a couple of my little checkpoints in that excitement on the first tee. I was reasonably confident I was going to hit a good shot. I didn't. It wasn't the worst in the world. I pulled it left. I didn't lose the ball, but, you know, it could have been a lot better. It was the chip shot, the two chip shots actually that followed that, was the moment when I wished the ground was going to swallow me up. But that's an entirely different story.
Gee. Well, when you went into that day, like, so who was in your group first and foremost? You had Ben Stokes.
So Ben Stokes and John Wilkin, who's a rugby league player and also a Sky colleague. And of course, our captain was Luke Donald, the Ryder Cup captain.
None other than. So how was that? I mean, did you pick his brains in the way around? Did you learn anything from him as a leader, as a pro, as a whatever?
First and foremost, Luke is an absolute gentleman and just was delightful, charming company, really good sport. He didn't take the day too seriously, you know, which helped made it for us. We were all a little bit in awe of him, and as were the crowd around us, you know, they couldn't get enough of him. And he was, in terms of his golf, it was more a case of us watching, really. And then watching him, the way he would go around it, particularly around the greens, I think that was the big learning. And he would just drop you a little hint now and again and say something about what he was doing and why he was doing it, which was really generous of him. The funny thing was, for some reason, you know, he would go first on his back championship tee, and then we'd come forward onto the white. We were playing off the white tees, and I was fourth in the order. That's how we started, and that's how it stuck for the entire day. So he'd hit his shot, and by the time he'd sort of walked forward, maybe Ben Stokes had hit his and John had hit his maybe as well. So I was always the last one. He would stand sort of directly in front of me, facing me, while I was hitting my tee shot, you know, right level with the tees. And, you know, if you were of a different nature, I think, or a different disposition, that could have been extraordinarily off-putting. But I don't know, in a strange way, I was quite flattered by it. And I took it as encouragement that he was standing there, and I was never going to slice it at him. That was impossible trigonometry to actually hit him with the golf ball. But there was a, you know, there was three or four times I would say where I hit a shot from the tee and he would be like, good shot, Dave. Yeah, like that. And those little words of encouragement would, you know, from someone like Luke Donald on a day like that were boom, straight in my top pocket and absolutely to be cherished.
That's brilliant. I mean, the bit about, so what, he's standing right in front of you, did you see?
Like, yeah, like 2 yards from me, yeah.
That's incredible. I almost wonder if that was a conscious thing in a way, like, because again, I reflect on, so is it Una Familia, the Sky Sports, released it recently, and just getting an insight into Luke Donald as a thinker, as a leader, and what he's all about, his ethos. And I almost wonder if that was somewhat intentional to send a message to you to say, I've got your back, Dave, you're all right, don't worry, you've got this. Or it might just be, he thought, you know what, I don't even need to worry because Dave's a solid golfer. Either way, Dave, that's a, you know, that, like you say, that's kind of like a inadvertent sort of pat on the back to you and like, yeah, you don't worry, we've got you. So
yeah.
Nice. Final question on the pro-am there. When you went into that, did you have any specific intentions or goals that you wanted to get out of that? Or was it more just like, do you know what? I'm going to enjoy the occasion.
Yeah, but that in itself was a goal because I'd spoken to a few people. Graham Souness springs to mind. He did it once and he hated it. He absolutely hated it. He said he was just too nervous. He couldn't enjoy the atmosphere, couldn't enjoy the company, and it wasn't for him. So you know, that was in the back of my mind. Someone like Graham, who's used to handling crowds and live audiences as a sporting performer, if he can't handle it, what's it going to be like for anybody else? And I had played in previous golf days on a much lower level where I had enjoyed that sort of bit of crowd interaction, but my golf had let me down too much to really enjoy it. And I put a little bit of pressure on myself in terms of my own golf, but the way that I think you really get to enjoy those things is by playing well. I think you have to sort of be almost a certain level of golfer to get something out of it in terms of that enjoyment. Not in terms of like, I feel like I'm taking on the professionals because I didn't think of it in that sense. Could I enjoy the day? Could I enjoy the fact there was a big crowd around me? Could I enjoy the company that I was with? Could I feel like I was putting my best side as a golfer forward? You know, when you start to sort of create your own Instagram as a amateur golfer, you're putting yourself out there. You're saying, I'm playing a lot of golf. And then people are looking at you going, well, doesn't look like it to me, mate, because you can't even hit the ball. Then that's not somewhere I wanted to really be. So, yeah, I think that was my target was to enjoy the day. And I can't tell you, from almost the second I left home to the minute I got back, I was just smiling so broadly. I just loved almost every second of it. Almost.
So the bits you did, what, the chips? Is that my right in hearing?
Yeah, on the first hole.
Thinking, why did you bring that
hole,
up again, Chris?
No, I'm happy to talk about it because it was quite a big.
I haven't seen them, by the way, so you get up to...
No. Why would you?
was it televised even?
Well, strangely, there were TV cameras around me at that point, which made me think that it might be in some way, but no. So the first shot down the hill on the first is on the left-hand side, as a lot were through the course of the tournament. Second shot is up to the right-hand side, my second shot, just short of a bunker. So all I had to do was feather a little chip on. You were talking 30 yards, something like that. I just hit completely under the ball. And it was one of those shots where I'd had to clear the crowd away before I hit the shot. So it was quite a dense group of people where my ball was. So I moved them out of the way, tried to hit this chip and completely fluffed it. You know, it went 2 yards. And then you want the ground to swallow you up. And then the next, basically the rule is if you can't, par is your friend. So if you can't do better than that, you pick your ball up. So I still, in effect, had one shot to try and get the ball in the hole to score on that hole. And so I was like, right, well, this time I'm going to chip it bloody close. At least I'll get a nice ripple of applause at the worst. You know, that's in the back of your mind as well. And I did exactly the same thing again. In fact, I think I even hit 1 yard the second chip shot. And at that point, it was just absolute silence all around me. And that is the worst possible thing as well. And then this bloke obviously took pity and he said, don't worry, Dave, it happens to all of us. Just a lone voice from the crowd. And I turned around in the direction the voice had come from. I said, yeah, but not in front of this many bloody people. There was a sort of smattering of laughter and whatever. And I was like, trying not to be embarrassed. Literally, that's the first thing. You're just so embarrassed at your own golf. So I picked my ball up, walked towards the second hole, which is the second tee, which is right there. It's a short par three. And I was thinking, do I get someone else to try and play this shot for me? Because I'm not sure I can actually hit this shot now. I'm not convinced I can A, make contact with the ball, B, get it anywhere near the green. I'm slightly worried about the amount of people that are here in terms of the crowds left and right. So the caddy said to me, would you like to take a pitching wedge? That's all it is. I went, no, give me a 9-iron. I'm just thinking I just need to make contact with the ball and I'm not going to try and hit it hard. I just need to try and hit the blooming thing. And so I took the 9-iron, stood on the tee, slow swing, hit the ball. It landed on the green. Ripple of applause from everyone who I think was feeling my pain and my embarrassment. And I was away and I was fine. And from that moment, I enjoyed it again. Ripped a drive down the third and was feeling all good about the world again. But for that moment, it was, goodness me, can you imagine if you did this and you're actually a professional golfer and suddenly your world just fell up, your world can fall apart in a tournament in one hole and how you mentally regroup in that moment just shows you how tough these guys really are. I think that as good as any sports people, really, I think test cricket is a real examination of, particularly a batsman, they only get one go. And that's it. That could be you're out. You're out again cheaply in the next innings, and your test career could be over. And I think golfers are in a similar battle a lot of the time, but it's how they bounce back so quickly, which is so admirable.
Absolutely. But I'm quite encouraged, actually, that you had that sort of response from that member of the audience, because it could have quite easily in those environments go the other way, couldn't it? You know, you could have someone, you know, that's maybe had an ale or two, say something and think they're being funny, or, you know, but actually that's nice. And yeah, it's a funny old game, isn't it? How you go from that to then, like you say, you knock the 9-iron on the green and then the driver crack it and then you're back in the swing of things. Yeah, something else that springs to mind there is, and maybe going back to what you're saying about Graham Souness, who really hated the experience, I almost wonder, you know, not saying that that's the case for him, but generally when, whether it's him or you or what you've described, David, you're someone who like doesn't do things in half measures. So when you are all about trying to do the very best that you can do, there's almost like a pride thing, isn't there? Which is like, oh, like I've just exposed myself and I feel like I should be doing better than this. And maybe again, you look at someone like Graham Souness, he's performed at the elite level in his sport, and then, you know, you're an elite presenter as well. It's a lot of what goes on in our head, isn't it? So
I think you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah, but moving on from that, one thing I want to dive into in a wee bit more detail was you alluded to how you've got your golf Instagram account, you've been growing that over time. You put yourself out there as an amateur golfer, so I would have, or some people might assume that someone like Dave Jones doesn't get imposter syndrome or whatever, given that, you know, you're a public figure and things. But I'm sensing that did you go into that whole exercise with total confidence, or has it actually been tricky at times to push through that kind of, if it is imposter syndrome or whatever, and putting yourself out there with the golf content?
I think it depends how you approach it. And I think, you know, I've not gone out there and tried to convince people that I'm a scratch golfer or anything like that. It's been very much the tone, if I've got it right, is very much, look, this is me. This is what I love doing. And I'm going to sort of share this journey with you. Not so much about how I'm playing, really, but the places I'm going to and the experiences I'm having. I'm not worried about people's judgment about me as a golfer, because I'm not a professional. I'm never going to be a professional golfer. I'm never going to be a scratch golfer. I'm pretty confident in that conviction. So I wouldn't say that I've got any fears, had any fears around that, really. I think for me, it was a natural thing to do, because I mean, Instagram is Instagram, but I fell out of love with Twitter and X some years ago and just found it too negative as a platform for me, and my mental health was Yeah, I suppose it was at times affected by it. And so I wanted to be in it somewhere else, but I was still conscious. I think when you're in the kind of world that I am as a profession, that people do want to know more about you, and you are encouraged, I suppose, to open the doors a little bit and share things. And I think probably what I found was with my main Instagram page was that probably most of the people on there weren't really golf fans. They weren't really interested in my golf journey. So I think it felt quite natural for me to start a separate one when I got more serious about it and could bore the pants off people as much as I wanted to in terms of what I was doing golf wise, what clubs I was playing with, where I was traveling, without fear of upsetting people's timelines or spamming them too much about a subject they weren't really interested in. So you know, the fact that I set up as a pure golf account, and so the I don't know, 4,000 or whatever it is Instagram followers I've got on there, still really small numbers, but I do know that that is a core golf loving audience that will send me messages about the things that I'm posting about. And I'm really happy to have interactions with people on there. And sure. I suppose what's interesting as well, Chris, is it's not just who you are messaging, but it's also what you're getting back. So the people that I follow on there is purely golf content. So on my other page, it's a lot of, what would it be on there? It would be, I suppose it's going to be more football based, isn't it? Because that's who I am. And that's what I surround myself with, football and lifestyle stuff. Whereas that is pure golf. And so I consume a lot of golf content, and some of it I think is quite good. And a lot of it I can just take it or leave it. And I'm not saying to anyone that what I'm doing is, I don't actually feel I've really got started with mine yet, to be honest. It's still a little bit of a holding pattern, and I'm waiting for that moment of inspiration and that time to really start making some progress. But I am keen to do it. I am keen to do it. And what I would like to do is start having some, basically playing some amazing golf courses. I barely play golf in Scotland. I've never played golf in Ireland. I've never played golf in Wales. And there are some amazing golf courses out there, I think particularly in Ireland and obviously Scotland as well, around the coast, all this links. Stuff that's out there, and I want to go and play as many of these as possible. We only get one shot at this, as you well know, Chris, and I want to, if I can, start visiting some of these places and taking a camera with me and showing everyone what they actually look like, and maybe taking some special guests with me along the way. That's what I would like to do.
That sounds amazing. It's just well, Scotland, I can obviously speak for, an absolute embarrassment of riches up there, and you've
extraordinary,
got
really, yeah.
Have you got any specific courses on your radar that you want to play?
Yes, I've been very, very fortunate to play the Old Course, and I've been a few times to Glen Eagles. So that's my Scotland experience right there. But I would love to just spend a week just near Edinburgh for a starting point, and just go and play around Gullen and North Berwick and these places. I'd love to visit King's Barnes. I would love to play golf in Northern Ireland. I'd love to play golf in Ireland. I was watching this TV program the other night, my wife and I were watching this thing, and it was in Gaelic, set in sort of I think it was County Donegal. The whole thing's in Gaelic, and I was looking at this landscapes and thinking, oh my god, that's just amazing golf territory. There it wasn't the point of the program at all, but that's all I could think about. And at the end of it, they went to this pub, and there was just this remote pub, the wind swept people coming out, coming inside to this sort of such a warm, convivial atmosphere, Guinness. I was like, oh my god, I need to go and play golf in Ireland. So that's what I've been spending January thinking about I've not been on the sick bed anyway.
only a golfer could watch a non-golfing program and just like drop.
It was a murder mystery program, and I'm just thinking about golf while I'm watching it.
That's quite relatable too. Dave, I had one final question for you. I really wanted to chat to you around the charitable work that you do and how you're using, or how golf is playing a role in that. So do you want to talk
a bit
about
that? You're trying to make me appear less shallow here.
not for a second. Dave, you are very thoughtful. I don't even need to, you know, that's clearly not an issue. You're not a shallow man. So, you know, I just, again, I was very drawn to that in, you know, given my own background, my own why and things. So, you know, and you posted about it, I think it was Sunningdale last year, wasn't it? You did a golf day for Blood Cancer UK. So how was that, and why is that cause especially so meaningful to you?
Well, if I go back to my list of reasons I started my golf Instagram, that would be one of them. My Blood Cancer Golf Day, which I sort of use my golf page unashamedly to generate leads as much as anything and touch points with people on what's a really special day for me. So the long story is my colleague at Sky, Simon Thomas, who I'm delighted to say is back at Sky now presenting Soccer Saturday. He tragically lost his wife, Gemma, to blood cancer some years ago. And they live quite close to us. I say us, me, my wife and my son. And there was Simon and Gemma and their son. And we were in very similar situations and we did similar jobs. And our wives had a lot in common and used to talk a lot about what they had in common and the sort of the pain of living with a nomadic football presenter who works every weekend. And not only that, the pain of not being able to have more children. And we both had the one child and were both going through courses of IVF, and they had an awful lot in common. We got word that Gemma was very poorly on a Monday, and by the Friday she died. And it was just the most, obviously, gut-wrenching experience for Simon and his son Ethan and their entire family and Gemma's family and friends. And, you know, it had a profound effect on me and my family as well. It felt like, well, why them and not us? What's that about? I spoke a lot to the charity that it was blood cancer, and Simon said he was going to help them as much as he possibly could. And I spoke a lot to the charity at the outset and said, well, I think I can help. If I use my profile, my contacts, my networks, I think I can help you do something about this. Not in any kind of God complex way, but in terms of funding some research to try and do my own little bit, really. So we launched the golf day, and Sunningdale was, I can't remember if it was the fifth one or the fourth one, but we've raised so far over £400,000 for the charity in those, I think it's five golf days. So we have done a bit. We've got to keep going, and it's a really special day because there's a mood of real friendship around the 80 or so people that turn up now every year. And it's not an exclusive club. People can always buy a table at it. I try and make it as expensive as I possibly can, Chris. I make no apologies that my aim is to raise as much money as possible. To do that, you have to push people, and you have to charge people, and you have to beg, and you have to borrow, and you have to rely on so much goodwill from other people. The sort of the USP of the golf day has been having three balls with a celebrity as sporting guests. All these people have given their time for nothing down the years, and these amazing companies have offered prizes and auction items, and you know, so there's been an awful lot of work has gone into it, and it's not just me. I'm just the front of it, the unrelenting driver, I think it would be fair to say, of this ship. But it does feel like you're doing the right thing, you know. I do sometimes look at people in my position and I think, why are you not doing stuff? I'm sure people do, but if you can help, why would you not? So that's my little baby, and I don't know where we'll go next year. Probably somewhere a bit cheaper than Sunningdale is the answer, but we haven't quite found it.
Why is that? Have you had a few people moaning about that price point? Is that why? Or
it's all economics, Chris. So the more you pay for a venue, the more impact you have on the profits. So. And of course, we want as much money as possible that's going funneling straight to the nerve center of the charity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a great cause, and like you say, it's wonderful to see Simon back in our screens these days. And I bet, does he attend it with you?
Or? He does. Yeah. He comes every year. You may know or not, he's remarried, and he's got two new children, brothers and sisters for Ethan. And he's in a really good place, I'm pleased to say. His golf is not in a good place, but he is in a good place.
Is he working on his golf as much as you are? Or
I think he needs to watch his podcast, because he tells me he has lessons. I think it's like, because we have golf days in September, you know, sort of middle of September. And I always get a voicemail message from him early September saying, I've just had a golf lesson. And I know that the last time he had a golf lesson was the first week of September the year before. So he just has, you know, I think he has one every year and never actually practices.
Well, maybe someday we'll get Simon on here and he can sort of defend himself and then actually tell us about like his golf goals and, you know, his game and stuff.
I think, as the father of two young children, he doesn't have too many goals in life right now beyond getting as much sleep as he possibly can. Golf is pretty low down the priority list, I would say, for him.
Well, I can well imagine, Dave, and I have a 9-week-old daughter at home at the moment. And you were saying earlier that you felt like a fraud when you reached a 9 handicap. I feel like a fraud at the moment, being a golf podcaster who's not actually getting out and playing any golf at the moment. So, you know, there's plenty of time for that. I've got my priorities straight and she is the apple of my eye.
Yeah,
and,
brilliant.
Really good. Dave.
What I would say, Chris, before we wrap up, because we've talked about a golf day, we've talked about my golf journey, the pro-am. There is nothing, golf for me is almost none of that, really. Golf for me is that feeling that you get when you walk down the first tee of any round of golf, and hopefully you're walking in a straight line as opposed to into the bushes down the left or in the trees on the right-hand side. Hopefully the sun is shining. I can visualize this feeling, walking down the first tee with a spring in my step. And you know, I walk quite quickly on the golf course. And to your ball, you've got a spring in your step, you've got a little bounce, and you're thinking, there is nowhere else I would rather be right now than on this golf course in pursuit of my ball and thinking about the next shot. And for 4 or 5 hours, whatever it is, that's all I'm thinking about. And I'm trying to keep everything else away, whether it's family stresses, work stresses, trying to just eliminate all of that for that brief period that you're out there in the countryside, breathing the fresh air, beautifully mown grass. For me, there is nothing better than that.
Amen to that. I couldn't agree more. So, Dave, I'm very, very grateful you've been so giving of your time. We've covered lots. Can't wait to get this episode out and for others to enjoy it, watch it, listen, however they want to consume it. And if you ever make it over to Wales, but you mentioned Wales earlier, you know where I am. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. Do remember to subscribe on the GYH Substack using the link provided in the show notes. That will get you access to exclusive content and member discounts. Our next episode is released on Monday the 10th of February and is only available to Substack subscribers, so make sure you get subscribed, don't miss out. And in the meantime, always remember to embrace the rough and forever cherish the fairway.